Thank you for the introduction and for the invitation to come here. It's been really nice so far, and I look forward to talking with people. So let's get started. So the title says it all. The Levin-Wen model is a gauge theory, and I'd like to convince you of that today. This work is on the archive. Also, I like your hockey stick pointer thing. It's been done with my collaborators, Corey Jones, Sean Sanford, Gabe Green, and David Pennies. So let's just get a little bit of, let's get our bearings here just a little bit and just write down a chart. So the Levin-Wen model is a model of topological phases in 2+1 dimensions. In particular, it produces tons of examples of topological phases. And furthermore, it's an exactly solvable model. So we like exactly solvable models because it helps us to understand the underlying phenomena, right? In particular, anyon theories. So topological phases of matter in 2+1 dimensions are known to have these interesting local sort of topological excitations. And the Levin-Wen model is a very effective way of generating models for them. So from the mathematical end, one more thing. So what this talk's going to be about gauge theory, so let me just say something about the connection to Levin-Wen models. So if you look at the original paper by Levin and Wen on their string nets, they say something about, you know, our model produces a lot of different gauge theories. And in turn, of course, that means that a lot of these gauge theories are topological phases. I'll return to that statement in a moment. But just know, a lot of these Levin-Wen models happen to also be gauge theories. So what did Levin and Wen do? Well, they said that if you take a unitary fusion category, if you don't know what that means, don't worry about it. We'll explain some of the details, although I promise not to tell you the full definition, because no one wants to hear that. But you take a unitary fusion category, some mathematical object, and you use that to construct this exactly solvable Levin-Wen model. And then you get this anyon theory out of that construction. But also, anyon theories have another relation to category theory. So in particular, I'm not going to use the word modular through the talk. I don't want to get into any details. But just, the point is, if you have an anyon theory, that's kind of the same thing mathematically as a unitary braided fusion category. And in particular, if you look at the if you take your fusion category and use it to construct a Levin-Wen model, you'll get some anyon theory, which is the same as if you'd gone this way. And this way is, for every unitary fusion category, there's this thing called the Drinfeld center. And the Drinfeld center is a unitary braided fusion category. So you can either take the Drinfeld center and look at that anyon theory, or you can construct the Levin-Wen model from your category and write down the anyon theory. And those are the same thing. So if you'd like, the Levin-Wen model is sort of a physical instantiation of the Drinfeld center construction. Also, feel free to interrupt and ask questions if you want. I don't know what the standard is here. So there's another nice mathematical object which has something to do with anyons. So given a unitary fusion category, you can write down something called the tube algebra. This reference here is not the first time the tube algebra shows up, but it's a good reference to put anyway. So to each fusion category, you have the, call the category C, you have the tube algebra tube C. And that's related to unitary braided fusion categories by looking at its category of representations. So if you look at the representation theory of the tube algebra of a given fusion category, turns out that's equivalent to the Drinfeld center. So in other words, you can sort of get insight into it in anyon theory by understanding its tube algebra from the Levin-Wen construction specifically. Not every anyon theory comes from a Drinfeld center. What we're going to do this talk is we're going to show another relationship. We're just going to build in one arrow that shows that if you start with a tube algebra symmetric theory, you can gauge that symmetry and turn it into a Levin-Wen model. And by virtue of having that arrow, we also have an arrow that goes this way too. So it's not just that some Levin-Wen models happen to be gauge theories, it's that all Levin-Wen models are gauge theories. That's the premise behind the talk. We're gonna do a little bit more motivation before getting into it. So as I mentioned, Levin-Wen model just describes a huge number of topological phases of matter. So even if we, so basically it's sort of a, it's a very important object. So anything we can understand about it, well, you know, it's nice to understand the structure, right? Because it's related to so many things. And as I mentioned, many Levin-Wen models happen to be gauge theories. So, you know, you might start wondering maybe there's a deeper connection there. And just as a note, if you look at the Levin-Wen Hamiltonian, it just looks like a gauge theory. Now, I've not written what these AV and BP terms are, but this AV looks a lot like a no-flux constraint. And BP looks a lot like an energy cost for having charges around. So just at a surface level glance, you might guess, well, maybe there's a reason for this. So that's why that's what got us thinking about, we saw some other examples, the ones that were traditionally thought of as gauge theories, and we thought, well, maybe this generalizes, and it does. And then the last thing is, I mentioned that if you'd look at the representation category of the tube algebra, that's the same thing as taking the Drinfeld center of that fusion category C. And in gauge theory, the usual story is if you have a gauge symmetry, your charges are the irreducible representations of your symmetry group. So maybe the representations of tube has something to do with like sort of topological charges. Now I'm pulling a very small sleight of hand here, but I promise I'll fix it later. So maybe there's a tube symmetry, just a moral. So let's just remind ourselves of what the Levin-Wen model is, just from a very high level. It's just a theory of these highly fluctuating strings, these labeled strings, with some kind of branching structure. So how they fuse together is somehow related to this fusion category. And the Hamiltonian basically just says, make these strings fluctuate rapidly. And I want to ask another question, which is, will be related to our central question about gauge theories. But it's a question, is the Levin-Wen model a theory of domain walls? So let me say what I mean by that. If you have a theory of domain walls, what that means is that you started with a theory of domains. So that is to say, imagine you have a bunch of sites on a lattice, and on each site you could have some state, and the domain walls are differences between neighboring states. So in other words, if you can write down this theory of domains, and it happens that it's, well, if you write down, if you can turn that into just a theory about the differences between states, then you say that this is, you now have a theory of domain walls. And this is something called the Kramers-Vanier transformation, and you can view it as gauging. So for example, if you take the trivial Z2 paramagnet, again, this is all in 2+1 dimensions. So you take the trivial Z2 paramagnet and do this sort of gauging and look at the theory of the domain walls between up and down spins, you get the torque code. And we'll do that example explicitly as a warm-up. Furthermore, if you take the non-trivial Z2 paramagnet, you'll end up constructing the doubled semion model as its theory of domain walls. And in general, if you have a theory of symmetry-protected phases, you can write down the theory of its domain walls, and that's called the quantum double for finite groups. So to rephrase what we're doing, what we're asking is the Levin-Wen model the theory of domain walls for some theory of domains? And by virtue of filling in these question marks here, we'll be able to claim that we obtain Levin-Wen through Kramers-Vanier gauging, and thus establishing that Levin-Wen is a gauge theory. Okay, so that's the outline. Any questions so far? I mean, just where we're headed.
So by symmetry-protected topological order, you mean the category is like VecG or something?
Yeah, VecG omega.
VecG.
Yeah, yeah.
So this gauging procedure, can I understand it as some kind of Morda duality, or?
It's a good question. I don't know. You probably know more about this than I do. I'm not sure is the real answer. Gauging is just taking the the in this in the case of like symmetry protected order, it's taking the Drinfeld center.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay, so now we get into the heart of things and start with an example. So let me just say what we're gonna say before we do it. So the idea is we're gonna just start with the classic gauging of Z2 paramagnet to produce Z2 lattice gauge theory, which is the toric code. And then we're gonna do a little bit of math and just, I have to introduce this thing called the diagrammatic calculus from fusion category theory. And that'll help us define Levin-Wen in a fairly clean way. Without reference to any of the underlying data like F symbols and so on, which is kind of nice if you don't like indices. Then we'll give the main result, which is just showing how to gauge some theory to obtain Levin-Wen. And then finally, we'll introduce a new type of symmetry protected order, which is the Fibonacci SPT. Turns out to be a trivial SPT, but I'll get into that later. That's a feature, not a bug, by the way. So the toric code, just to remind everyone, is you have a theory of spins on each lattice edge. So spin 1/2 here and here and here and here, so on. And the Hamiltonian is built out of these vertex and plaquette terms. So I guess I can point with the stick, not the shadow. So these are the vertex terms, and they look like the product of sigma x on all four edges neighboring a vertex. If you'd like, it's saying an even number of up in x spins and down in x spins. And BP is very similar. So these are the plaquette operators, and you take the product of sigma z along these four edges. This is a commuting projector model. If you know what that is, it's basically the simplest thing you could do. Now we want to see how the toric code can be viewed as a Z2 gauge theory. So we're going to write down its theory of domains to produce this theory of domain walls. And in particular, on the left side, we're going to have a Hamiltonian, which is basically says, you could view it two different ways. You could say all the spins point in the Z direction, or you could say every spin is in a cat state of up and down in X. So that's kind of this more like highly fluctuating kind of interpretation. So that'll be the Hamiltonian on this side. And note that on this side, we have a 2 to the 16 dimensional Hilbert space. On that side, it's 2 to the 24 dimensional. So whatever map I construct to get from one side to the other, it's certainly not surjective. And that's going to be important. So trivial Z2 paramagnet, we have a spin 1/2 on each site. And you can write down a basis for this, where with spin up and down in X. So the blue sites will be up in X, and the green sites will be down in X. And that allows you to write down what the domain walls are. So we want to construct this map from this Hilbert space of domains to the Hilbert space of domain walls. And so we just say if you have a difference between two sites, you say there's a domain wall there. And that's represented by a down X spin, which I've labeled in orange. And these thin black lines will be sort of like no domain wall or the trivial domain wall. And so this is, I've told you where this linear map sends basis elements, so I've told you exactly what the linear map is. And it turns out that this Hamiltonian on this side, which says flip every downspin to an upspin and upspins to downspins on each individual site, that's gonna turn into the plaquette terms. So it says, if you flip a spin, what you need to do is you need to toggle each of the domain walls around, going from orange to black or black to orange, right? Because you're changing whether you're the same or different than your neighbor. And so in other words, the Hamiltonian induced by this transformation is the plaquette terms in the Hamiltonian of toric code. I want to show you this counting again. So you have 2 to the 16 dimensional domain space and a 2 to the 24 dimensional edge space. But if you look at just at the symmetric part of the space on the domain side, that's 2 to the 15 dimensional because that's a Z2 symmetry, just spin flip. And if you look at the image of the AV equals 1 projectors, that is the flux-free sector, that's also 2 to the 15. dimensional. So in fact, there's one-to-one correspondence between the dimensions of the symmetric space on the ungauged side and the dimensions of the flux-free space, subspace, on the gauged side. So this is going to be very important for us. Okay, great. So, oh, and by the way, I should mention the fact that we have a Hamiltonian induced on that side. Naively, you might, because you induced by this map here, if we didn't have a one-to-one correspondence between these things, it's kind of, you know, you're like, okay, how am I doing that exactly? You can still do it, but anyway, it's good to know that it really is just a unitary map, so you can just conjugate to get the action, get the Hamiltonian. So what did we learn from this example? It's that we can see that there's a way of viewing gauge theories, or at least this type of gauge theory, as being sort of a theory just of the domain walls. It's equivalent to the original theory in some sense. In that the symmetric ungauged space is sort of the same as the gauged space, gauged Hilbert space with no flux. And this is a general result. So for like quantum double, for instance, you still find this. And it'll be true, although I won't do the counting, it'll be true for Levin-Wein as well. So this is the caveat I had to issue earlier. So the gauge symmetry is a Z2 symmetry. And if you look at the irreducible representations of Z2, there are only two of them. But in the Torque code, where, you know, we know there are four anions. So there are two that you might call, well, there's one that's kind of like nothing, then there's one that's kind of like a charge. But so this isn't really the right thing to look at irreps of if you want all the anions. That thing is called the Drinfeld double, so DZ2. It's a four-dimensional algebra. And this is the same as what it's something called the tube algebra. This will hold for any group you put in there, by the way. Great. So the point is that I'm not going to, when I say that you have a tube gauge symmetry, I'm not saying it in the same sense as like a group. What I'm really saying is that there's an algebra induced by the group symmetry that your ungauged model turns out to be symmetric with respect to, and that's the thing I want to compare to. So it's a slight generalization. So it's true that all symmetry groups generate this symmetry algebra, this tube algebra thing, as shown there. It's vec of your group, a tube vec of your group. But it turns out, I guess I'm not going to prove this, but not all symmetry algebras like this correspond to some symmetry group. It's not everything's the double of something. Okay, so let's do the Levin-Wein model. So in order to introduce the Levin-Wein model, I have to tell you what the Hilbert space is. And we'll get the Hilbert space through diagrammatic calculus. And I'm following this way of constructing these things that we had in a previous paper. We did not invent diagrammatic calculus, but this way of doing Levin-Wein is from that paper. So fusion categories. I'm going to give you a minimal description. So you have these things called objects, and this in a fusion category, which will be labeled by lines, and these things called morphisms. And morphisms will be represented by dots, or maybe just empty space, between lines. So morphisms go between objects. Now we're going to hit pause here, because if I keep on that track, we're going to be here for another couple hours. So let's just look at a familiar example. That's quantum circuits. So your qubits are like lines in a quantum circuit, and your gates are like dots or boxes. The space that we're interested in is not the qubit spaces, but the spaces of gates. So this forms a four-dimensional Hilbert space. Oh, by the way, when I say fusion category, secretly every time I'm saying unitary fusion category, but I'm omitting it because I don't want to overload with what I mean by things. But the point is, you have a nice Hilbert space of morphisms. And in fact, say you have like three qubits going into a gate and four qubits coming out, you still have a nice Hilbert space of morphisms. Okay. And again, remember we're trying to build some nice Hilbert spaces. delete that. Sorry, I don't know what happened. There we go. So we're trying to introduce the Hilbert space for the Levin-Wen model. That's why I'm focusing on the fact that the spaces of gates are Hilbert spaces. So furthermore, you can link up a bunch of, so this is a perfectly well-defined quantum circuit if you fill in what those boxes are, what kinds of gates those are, and there's you still have a nice Hilbert space of gates. And so you can imagine looking at all the possible quantum circuits with this particular topology, that's a vector space. Okay, so now we can return to this picture. So you have these things called objects. These are going to be the lines in these diagrams. And there's a finite list of simple objects. And the simple objects are going to, you should think of them as a way of sort of helping us form basis states that we'll use to describe this our Hilbert space. And also, just like with the quantum circuit example, the morphisms form a vector space. And for unitary things, it forms a Hilbert space. And so what we're going to do is we're going to think about Hilbert spaces generated from diagrams. So in particular, here's probably the best, or like here's the thing that makes this useful is that there's this thing called the fusion product in a fusion category. And what it means is just that if you have two objects, A and B, you can look at something called their fusion product and study all the morphisms from A times B into C. And that'll allow us to make interesting diagrams because now we have trivalent vertices. So if you didn't follow any of that, don't worry, because I'm going to summarize the main point behind fusion categories that we'll care about as far as diagrammatic calculus goes. It's that you can think of a fusion category as a nice map which takes a diagram and sends it to a vector space. And it's like a collection of consistent ways of doing this. So there's going to be a vector space at each of those three points. And the idea is that you're going to have a vector space. So this vector space would be like green times red into blue. And then this will be orange goes into red times teal. And then you have the last term, it's going to be tensor blue times teal goes into pink. This is almost the vector space you get out of this, but it's subject to some relations. So I mentioned that I have diagrammatic calculus on a plane, and what that means is that I sort of get to wiggle the lines around. So in particular, on a plane, what I can do is I can kind of cinch up that triangle. So this is actually just a map from green times orange into pink. So this diagram turns out to be the vector space corresponding to this diagram is isomorphic to the vector space corresponding to that diagram. So that's a unitary map between them. Okay. Now, I mentioned there are some relations. So here's the two main ones that we're going to use. There are more, but so this is, you may be familiar with like F symbols and stuff. So there's this F move, which takes a vector space of corresponding to this diagram to a vector space corresponding to that diagram over there. And I've omitted some direct sums, but also over here, if you just have two lines that are doing nothing, you can equivalently represent that as sort of a formal sum or a direct sum of diagrams that look like this, where you put some simple object in the middle. So E or C refers to the simple objects of the category C. So you don't have to understand the details of that, but the point is that there are some diagrammatic relations which tell you about some linear maps between various diagrams, the vector spaces corresponding to various diagrams. For example, if you look at VEXI2, the diagrammatic calculus looks like this. So, first, the VEXI2 is the category where your objects are Z2 graded vector spaces, and the simple objects are both one-dimensional complex vector spaces, and one of them is the trivially graded one-dimensional space. The other one is the non-trivially graded vector space. And if you take the tensor product of the non-trivial one-dimensional vector space with itself, that's the same as the trivial vector space, a trivial one-dimensional vector space. And that's sort of encapsulated in these relations. These are the diagrams corresponding to non-zero dimensional vector spaces. They're all one-dimensional. So these are the trivalent vertices that are non-zero, but you could also write down your four-valent vertex spaces that are non-zero, or Hom spaces if you'd like. So it's these eight here. Now these might look a little familiar to you now because we just looked at the torque code, and the torque code is what you get when you gauge a Z2 paramagnet. So these are actually the vertices that diagrammatically look like the image of the AV terms. So an even number of upspins coming in and out. So that is if you look at this ground state of the AV terms, this is one of the ground states of the AV terms, you'll see diagrams that look like this. So there's always an even number of lines at each vertex. Now, okay, so I have to introduce this idea of putting punctures in the plane. So I told you about diagrammatic calculus on the plane. But you can also do diagrammatic calculus on any surface. It's just that your like wiggling relation, lines are allowed to move around, you don't get quite as many relations as you did. So in particular, like if you have a puncture here, you can't, it's this diagram is a different state than that diagram. Which makes sense, because in the toric code, if you just look at like the spin states, these are obviously different spin states, because these two are up and those two are down, and vice versa over there. So they should correspond to different states in your Hilbert space. But there's a nice thing you can do, which is the BP operators, they patch holes. You can patch a puncture with a BP operator. So what do I mean by that? So if you apply the BP operator here, you can look at the image of the projection onto the BP equals one state. And in the image of that projection, these two states are now equal. So you have two states in your big Hilbert space, you apply a projection, and they both get sent to the same element of this new subspace. And so the idea is if you apply BP to every single plaquette, now your ground states are just all the diagrams allowed to wiggle freely. Move across the plaquettes. And really, although in out loud I was saying toric code this whole time, in my head I was saying Levin-Len, because it's the exact same story. So if your edges are now labeled by simple objects of your category, your fusion category, then the image of the AV terms, what they do is they say, it's saying, you want your diagrams to be sort of valid diagrams on this punctured planar diagrammatic calculus, this vector space that you can get. So in other words, if you look at the ground state of this, the ground state of these operators is the same as the vector space of all diagrams you can draw on this, I guess, 24 times punctured plane. And similarly, if you apply, so they're the BP operators, and I'll go into more detail explicitly about what those are, but it's the same story that once you apply the BP operators and look at the ground states of all of these operators, it's gonna be so you only apply BP on the interior. So the ground states are gonna be any diagram that you can draw on this surface, subject to the relations that I described earlier. So in particular, what these x's, so you might ask, what are those x's still doing there? And the point is you can fix the boundary. So like these boundary edges are kind of like stuck being what they are because you can't move this line past here to fuse with that line, for instance. And the point is that you can write down a ground state of this model for any boundary configuration of objects you set down. In a more physical way of saying that, what that really means is that you have this highly degenerate ground state space due to your edges. So in other words, you have protected edge modes along the boundary, topological edge modes, because there are all these configurations have the same energy. Okay, so let me just quickly tell you what the BP operator actually is, because you can understand it through this calculus, and then you'll know the Levin-Wen model. So let me just remind you, so every state in the space is some diagram with these various trivalent vertices or maybe four-valent vertices, so on. So it's any diagram you can draw on this punctured plane. So there's an operator that says, take a diagram and just put a circle around the puncture. So you have some simple object R. Just glue in that line. That's a way that I've just shown you. You have an original state. Now that's a new state. It's still a diagram on the punctured plane. That's a linear map. I've told you how to send things over, right? And so your BP operator, up to some like normalization constants, is just its action on states is just take a state, apply this R thing here, and do that for each R. And there's a way to resolve these diagrams and put it back in the nice basis state where you only have these four valent vertices, but it's sort of irrelevant how to do that for our purposes, so we're not going to. Okay, that's the 11-1 model. So now we'll get into some of the new results. Unfortunately, I will have to give you one more piece of mathematical overhead, but I promise it'll be worth your time because the tube algebra is great. So we want to show the 11-1 model's gauge theory. To do that, we're going to do two things, basically. I'm going to show you that it's a theory of domain walls, which is almost enough to say it's a gauge theory. It's kind of like gauge-like, but it's not quite because gauge theories have symmetries. So I have to show you I have to have a theory of domains with this tube algebra symmetry. But to do that, I also have to tell you what the tube algebra is. So tube algebra is, even if you don't take anything away from the new results, I think maybe it'd be worth your time just to know what the tube algebra is anyway, just because it's so nice. Okay, so as I mentioned, you can do diagrammatic calculus on the plane. And we also saw you can actually do it like on a punctured plane. You can do diagrammatic calculus on any surface. And the point is that you assign vector spaces to each vertex, and you take the tensor product and mod out by some certain relations. And that's your vector space. And the point is, so in a plane, you can reduce all diagrams to just like a bunch of lines coming into a point and some lines coming out of the point. I should say that, so in this case, these spaces are isomorphic, but it won't always be. In principle, you might just map into a subspace of that over there. But that's just a caveat. But okay, so now you can just do diagrammatic calculus on a tube. So here's some diagram you could write on a tube. But it turns out, just like the plane, where you could kind of condense everything to a point, on a tube, you can almost do that, but tubes have this like non-trivial loop that you can go around that you can never contract a line over. So actually, if you have diagrams with one incoming line and one outgoing line from the top, all of them can be reduced to something of this form. Okay. So if you zoom in just at this little plus here, really what we're saying is that the tube algebra, or so this diagram, the vector space corresponding to this diagram is, if you read it like kind of that direction, this is the Hom space, or the space of morphisms from A times B into C times A. So as a vector space, our tube algebra is sort of, if you were to take all the direct sum of all the vector spaces that look like this, changing those various labels. So that's the tube algebra as a vector space. So of course, so algebras are vector spaces with a multiplication structure. So I better tell you the multiplication structure. So suppose I've got a tube that looks like this. So maybe you've put some vector there. So you're in some state and you've got a tube that looks like this, and you've got some state sitting there at that vertex. Well, if you multiply this one by that one, all you have to do is stack one on top of the other. So you stack them, and then you ensure that this line is the same as that line. Those simple objects are identical, so you put in this delta here. And this is still a diagram on a tube, and I haven't shown you why, but I've promised you that everything can be reduced to that form again, so you can calculate all your structure constants of your algebra. But multiplication is pretty simple. It's just stacking tubes. So two tube algebra elements, you just stack one on top of the other. That's multiplication. You can convince yourself that this is associative, because you mean 1, 2, 3, didn't matter which two you stacked first. Okay, so as I mentioned, we care about the tube algebra because, or at least one of the reasons to care about it as a physicist would be that the representation category of your tube algebra corresponds to your theory of Levin-Wien anyons. So there is a slight hitch with this. So I'm going to promise you that I'm going to have a tube algebra symmetric theory, but there's no standard tensor product of the representations of a tube algebra. So physically, what do I mean? It's that suppose you wanted to write down a lattice model with a tensor product Hilbert space, and you act your tube algebra on this space. And the way you act it is by acting on each site individually. Well, it turns out that if you tried to do that, your actual algebra in total isn't the tube algebra anymore. So it breaks. Or if you try to act your tube algebra on the whole space and you ask, how does it act on each individual component? Well, those don't look like tube algebra representations either, just some other gross thing. So you have to, yeah.
I have a question on this. So yeah. The tube algebra, it's supposed to be some kind of half thing, right? It's a half algebraic kind of thing. So it should also have a coproduct.
So it does not.
It doesn't?
No. Or at least, I mean, Theo might know better.
I'm trying to parse the first bullet point. You said there's no tensor product, but of course you told me the representations are this tensor category. So somehow there must be a tensor product that you presumably that knows more.
Uh-huh.
That sort of is the tensor product on Z of C.
Mm-hmm. So that's right.
And that tensor product should come from the coproduct on the tube algebra.
The issue is that it's the tensor product on that category doesn't live over the tensor product on underlying vector space. It's not a hop function.
Yeah.
Because Z of C doesn't have a fiber factor. But there is a tensor product of representations.
Mm. Oh yeah. So
I agree with
It's the deconvolution product.
So I agree with Hank that it's like not going to be a half algebra. There should be some half algebraic structure.
Yeah, half algebraic kind of stuff. Mm. But nevertheless, you define your tube algebra, you kind of specify all the algebra and coalgebra structures. I mean, you can define braiding as well, right? Like,
mm-hmm.
Yeah.
But the point is that you can't just use. So the statement is if you have like a tube algebra module and another tube algebra module, their tensor product as vector spaces does not induce.
That's correct.
Yeah.
That's true.
Mm-hmm. So we'll flash like one slide having to do with this. But
the tensor product here comes from doing like scans on a pair of hands.
That's right.
This is, so it doesn't look like a coproduct at all.
Exactly. So I'll show you a diagram that's going to look an awful lot like that, and so we'll see what it looks like. So,
question.
Yeah.
Considering like a G gauge theory for some group G, mm-hmm. The tube of C is just G. Is that?
It's the double of G. So I should be more clear. So I'm going to define this a symmetric lattice model without the usual vector space tensor product. It'll still have another kind. Now, for physics, that might be a little concerning because we're used to having these nice local structures on Hilbert space. But it's sort of okay because the algebra of operators still has a nice local structure. And so your algebra of operators, you know, you're fundamentally looking at your observables in your theory. So your theory is still local. Its underlying Hilbert space is not. Now, if you'd like, you can look at a true tensor product Hilbert space and look at a subspace of that space, which is not a standard tensor product, and view the tube algebra symmetry as an emergent symmetry. So there are different ways out of this, but it's not sort of a physical problem in the end. So what I want to do now, okay. If you've been sleeping until now, wake up because this is where the new stuff really happens. So we're going to build something called the spine coral skein module. So I was really happy because we were able to cite this paper from this marine biology paper from 1873 where someone sketched this spine coral after going on some adventures. So Okay, so in this is, so from here on out, this will basically be our own work, which we've posted to the archive. So this looks like a pair of pants for an octopus, which has one too many legs and is upside down. Okay, so let me deconstruct this diagram for you. So if you look at, so we're going to be looking at like our diagrammatic calculus on the spine coral. So to get from this picture, so this is like a disc with 9 punctures in it. So if you take the bottom here and like grow the bottom and expand it out, and then you push down on the top, you can imagine making this whole thing planar. And that, this is the picture you'll get. So that's just like topologically, these are the same. Now you can label your basis state, you can label your states by just labeling each of these red lines with simple objects in your category. And anytime you have a vertex, there's just some vector there corresponding to these hom spaces. I didn't draw the blue dots on these sort of interstitial ones, but they're still, you still have to make choices of these vectors here. Okay, so this is your space. Now let me, I'll get more into the space later. So if you don't understand it, totally don't worry. But I want to tell you what the tube algebra does. So its action on this space is by just gluing the tube onto the bottom. So just like you can stack tubes on this coral. And that's, so again, this is when you glue this on, it's still the same shape, still the same surface that you're doing your diagrammatic calculus on. So sort of by definition, this is another one of the states in your theory, so that's a well-defined linear map. Also, you could act the tube on top. Now, we're actually only going to look at a subalgebra of these things, so just the ones where it's just a ring like that. The details of why we're doing that aren't really relevant right now. I can answer it later, though. But the point is you can just stack a tube on top, and again, that's just some operator acting on that side.
So just making that in the case, in the usual gauge theory case, this ring algebra is the group algebra, or it's the representation ring, or which is it?
Group algebra. That's right. And so so this will be, just acting, left multiplication, if you'd like.
Okay, this is literally just the actual symmetries.
So the symmetry will act as a right group action in this notation, and the action of tube on the individual sites would be a left action, so they commute with one another.
Sure, but I'm just trying to match which who are the in the group in the case of a gauge theory, who are the group elements and who are the Wilson. That's what I was trying to
do. Oh, I see. Yeah. So right now this will be the ungauged theory. And so what it'll be is, so none of these interior lines exist. It'll only be red rings around here. And each of those red rings is allowed to be a group element. And then the action of these operators will be left multiplication by that group element. And the action on the bottom, turns out it'll split onto each tube individually as right multiplication.
Because there's no trivalent vertices in the group case. Mm-hmm. But the tube algebra is still better. It's still the double algebra because there are 4 valent vertices in the group case.
There are 4 valent vertices. That's right. But they'll act as 0 on this space.
Good.
Yeah, so that's a good point. So a lot of the time we're not going to see the whole tube algebra. So on that point, you might wonder, how are you going to get all of Levin-Wen? And that'll turn out to be part of the gauging procedure. So we can stack a tube on a site, and that's some local operator. And we're going to use that to define our Plaquette operators, or in this case, I guess we're still on the domain side, so these will be like vertex, on each tube. BV acting on this the top of one of the spine corals is going to be the sum with some weights of all the ways you can stack this ring on top of that piece of the coral. And it turns out there's a nice interpretation of this as sort of capping off the top of the coral And what I mean by that is if you look at the image of this BV operator, it gives you a state where you can actually take this ring and move it around the top and cinch it closed. And I didn't tell you what one is, but basically there's an object in a fusion category called the unit object. It turns out that, and you draw it like an invisible line, so actually lines aren't allowed to end, so this will be zero unless you had the identity going up into there. Everything else gets projected away. So it turns out this is a commuting projector model, because if you were to stack tubes on different sites, it doesn't matter what order you do that in. And the ground state is, imagine if you had, like, you cap off all the tops of the coral and get rid of all the red lines. That's the ground state of this model. So we don't have the standard tensor product Hilbert space, but what we do have is on a finite lattice, we still have a symmetric Hamiltonian, because stacking on top and stacking on bottom commute. We still have a symmetric Hamiltonian, and it's a gapped ground state. So gapped ground states in a lattice model, normally what you would say is that's trivial topological order. Now, since we don't have the standard tensor product Hilbert space, it's a little bit hard to use the usual definition of short-range entanglement, but we have another physical signature of this being trivial. So this is important because I could have said, well, you know, maybe we start with a different theory. If we had a different starting point, maybe that theory would be long-range entangled already. And then I say, you can do some transformation, show you I get the Levin-Wen model, and I say, ta-da, we've produced Levin-Wen through gauging. But the truth is the original theory we started with may have already had this sort of entanglement, you know, long-range entanglement built in. And so we really wouldn't be doing anything, but here this is sort of saying we're starting with a trivial theory and then we're going to gauge it to get something non-trivial. So in the ungauged model, we can, I want to interpret this as a bunch of domains. So I'm going to fill in each of these circles with blue. And what we're going to zoom in on one of these things. I just want to show you what the on each site, what the space looks like. So in this domain interpretation, what we're doing is we're saying we're going to label the domain by an object x, and you can have some line coming in labeled by y. And this x is saying that the line going around it is an x-type line. And so the Hilbert space on this site is, if you were to just sum over all the different x's and y's and look at the direct sum of all the spaces that you have there on the vertex. And so in other words, this is y, all the morphisms from y into x check x. So x check is kind of like x inverse. It's not really, but you can think of it like that, like it's x going in the opposite direction. So this is like incoming x and outgoing x. That's why it's y goes into x check x. So alpha lives in this Hilbert space somewhere. And you can think about this physically as this is an X domain whose boundary is twisted by the pair alpha y. In the group-like case, you don't ever have this. There's no way to do it. But in other cases, like Fibonacci, for instance, you can. So if you have two sites, you could imagine doing similar things. So you pick an alpha here and a beta here. But I have to make a little bit of a caveat. The mathematicians in the room. So what we're really doing to build this spine coral is this thing called the deconvolution product, which we can talk about. I know the deconvolution product in this context. I know there's a more general story, so which I don't know. But anyway, this is behind the scenes. This is what we're doing to build the spine coral. So back to the kind of physical picture. The idea is, if you have this X domain and a Y domain, we're going to do this Kramers-Vanier style transformation and glue them together. So you imagine growing domains until they bump into each other. And now what you have is an X check Y, or an X dual Y line right there. And so this is for two sites. But if you have more, what are we going to do? Well, Oh, by the way, this is the same as if you had like an upspin domain and a downspin domain. Between them, you have a domain wall. This is just saying like you have an x over here and a y over here. Between them, there's this x check y thing. So I'm going to draw this diagram a little bit differently because I want to put the punctures back in. But the idea is you have like these blue domains in here. And if I grow those domains, you get this picture. So you can kind of see if you're to grow each of these bubbles, these red bubbles until they start bumping into each other, you're going to get 9 of these blue regions, which are each still punctured. And you could alternatively look at your Hilbert space that way. And now furthermore, there's just like white space in here. So you can actually shrink these 4 trivalent vertices down into a 4-valent vertex. And if you do that, actually what you've produced is the Levin-Wen Hilbert space. So this is the first step in the gauging process, is smashing those together. So in fact, it's kind of the only step. So now your edges are labeled by simple objects. Your 4-valent vertices are now these Hom spaces. X, Y goes into Z, W. So that's exactly this is the image of the AV terms, the flux-free Levin-Wen Hilbert space. So this is just like with the torque code where we said you're in the image of the AV terms, you're in the flux-free torque code space.
Right. In 10 plus
10 minutes? Oh, great. Yeah, plenty of time then. Thank you. So if you look at the Hamiltonian that's induced by the domain Hamiltonian, well, what are you doing here? So you're stacking a tube on top. But of course, that tube, that hole through the middle, becomes the puncture on the Levin-Wen side. So what you're doing is you're gluing in a line on the inside. And that's exactly what I showed you earlier is the Levin-Wen Hamiltonian, is you sum over a bunch of terms like this. They have the same coefficients, by the way. Okay. So in fact, actually, this is your induced Hamiltonian is exactly the Levin-Wen model. So if you think about this as Cronos-Varnier gauging, what we set out to do was to ask, can we write a theory of domains to turn the Levin-Wen model into a theory of domain walls? And in fact, you can, or to represent it as a theory of domain walls. And the answer is that, well, your Hilbert space is this deconvolution product over all these local sites, and your BV, which turns into BP on the other side, your BV operators are just stacking tubes, and they become gluing these circles in across punctures. So, and we also have recovered the idea that this we should think of as a flux, because that's the flux-free condition is what gave you the flux-free Levin-Wen Hilbert space. And the charges are the excitations from this side, just like the torque code and every quantum double. So you can run this story for those as well. So in fact, Levin-Wen is a gauge theory with this tube algebra symmetry. So, we've done what we need to do. So I still have a couple minutes. So I'll go ahead and show you an example. So just how would this work with Fibonacci category? Well, the Fibonacci category has 2 simple objects, 1 and tau. And if you take tau cross tau, that gives you 1 plus tau. Those are the fusion rules. And so if you fuse n taus together, you get the 1 plus tau with the coefficients being valued in the Fibonacci sequence. So that's why it's called Fibonacci category. And I'm just pulling a diagram from our paper, which kind of shows these are the various relations we're going to need to use to do the gauging procedure. So by the way, so phi is the golden ratio. So let's start with just what does the Hilbert space look like on each site? It's going to be 3-dimensional. So there's the empty top of the, so this is the top of the coral. So there's the empty one. There's one with the tau ring, and there's one with the tau ring with the tau coming off the bottom. And so if you look at 2 sites, you have 2 3-dimensional sites. So what you would expect probably is 9 different configurations. But that's not the world we're living in. There's a 10th one. And that's so basically you can choose either to have a red line come out the bottom of this or not. And that gives you a 10th site. And actually, if you if you investigate this, if you have insights, this is not in the paper, but the Online Encyclopedia of Integer Sequences is one of my favorite websites, and it turns out that if you count the number of terms in total, you get this as the dimension of your Hilbert space. If you do a Galois conjugation of root 5, you can see that this is at least a rational number, but it turns out it's an integer. Okay, so an example state in our space would be something like this. Around each of these holes, you may or may not have a red ring. And on each red ring, you may or may not have a line coming out of it. And any two red lines meet, you may or may not have another red line coming down. So that's the full Hilbert. You can imagine all such states. That's your Hilbert space. And so let's just look at what happens if you gauge a site. So, or gauge a four site model here. If you look at this on the plane, it looks like this, this punctured plane. So we're going to bring these two together, these two lines. And then we're going to kind of go underneath this connecting line and bring those two together. And if you use these relations, well, what you can get is that this is the same as this, which is then the same as this down here. And these are actually states which are valid in the Levin-Wynne Hilbert space. So let me conclude. So in fact, the Levin-Wynne model is a gauge theory with a tube algebra sort of generalized symmetry. And it happens that it not only is a gauge theory, but you can get it through this kind of standard Cromer-Vanier type story. And our charge and flux operators are, in fact, aptly named. And now we have, although there are other physical meanings to this, we have a new physical meaning in terms of gauge theory for this formula here. And there's some details in extra slides, which I probably won't have time to show, but if you're curious, I can show you. And in fact, we have a new class of tube algebra SPTs. Now, I do want to say that these all the ones we're producing should be considered as trivial tube algebra SPTs. So what I mean by that is the sort of data, like the associator data, for instance, that's involved in your fusion category, isn't going to show up in the ungauged model. The place that shows up is in gauging. So when we bring the lines together, we have to use various relations on your skein modules, or your diagrammatic calculus on surfaces, and that's where it comes in. So one of the things, if anyone has any ideas, I'd be really interested to hear. If anyone knows how you might produce a non-trivial SPT and do an untwisted gauging process as opposed to our twisted gauging process from a trivial SPT. So I look forward to chatting with you all. So thank you to my collaborators, our various funding sources, and of course the Perimeter Institute for inviting me here. Anyone wants to chat about these things, please let me know.
This Fibonacci SPT. Mm-hmm. So, what you said, is it true that, for example, you can't look at any behavior on the edge of this SPT, like physical edge, to infer that there is this Fibonacci structure?
So the edges, you can totally gap it out. Yeah. So it really is a trivial theory. So it'd be kind of like asking, you know, if you have different group symmetries, you could have trivial theories with each of those group symmetries, but you still have the symmetry to tell you something about fib. So the symmetry action itself is the information.
So there's no order parameter of any kind?
No.
So in your construction in this paper, I like the choral picture, by the way.
Oh, thanks, that's my favorite part.
So you started with the fusion category, mm-hmm. what Levin-Wynne did, and that's, you need semi-simplicity, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
How much semi-simplicity do you actually need?
Oh, good question. That's a really good point. So part of it is, let's see, so if I'm remembering right, So I guess there's two aspects to that question, right? So it's finite number of simple objects and something about like n spaces over the simples. So as far as the number of simple objects, you could probably have an infinite number. I don't see immediately where that goes wrong. You definitely still want some version of it where every time you fuse two things together, you want to decompose into a finite number, just so you can kind of write down a nice basis. But yeah, the other part of that, I don't know. We're probably using it somewhere, but I don't know if it's essential. Yeah.
Right. Because I think something very similar was done in one of Clement's paper. One of Clement's old paper, where he looks at something like this, but with SU2.
Right.
So, be it a while, you have
sure.
Still finite rank irreducibles, but you have infinitely many of them.
That's right. Yeah, yeah.
Fusion is still dimensional. Mm-hmm. So.
Yeah. Well, so on that, I mean, I think the thing that's happening, I thought a little bit about some things like this. So, right, the standard gauge theory story is very much like that. You have continuous symmetries and you have, you know, infinite numbers of irreducibles, but it's kind of okay because they have, you know, it's like the other parts of similar simplicity are still there. So yeah, one thing I'd love to know is how this story interacts with kind of a more traditional gauge theory story, like, you know, continuous theory. So if you want to talk about that, that'd be great.
Yeah, for sure. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Like Clement's paper tells you that the tube algebra you get is the Drumfeld double. But specifically for SU2. But I think you can do this for leaves.
Mm. Oh, great, great.
Come back.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, sure. Yeah.
So, yeah, we'll talk.
Great.
Thanks.
Thank you.
This is just a historical question. What were Levin and Wen thinking when they wrote down their model?
I remember talking to Michael about this once. I remember because I was writing my thesis and I was trying to pick his brain, but it was a hectic time of life. So let's see. I think the story goes something like this. I think they talked to the guy at Santa Barbara, Wang. I think Levin and Wen like basically brought him something and were like, hey, look at all these things you can do. He's like, you should look at fusion categories, and then they wrote the thing down. I should remember that story because I did ask him once. Yeah.
Did Levin Wen his claim made up? That right?
After? Probably. I don't remember.
Wait, the claim Tri-Vero is the one, isn't
it? Oh, Tri-Vero was that first?
Yeah. I mean, Tri-Vero sort of sketched something, and then. The correct math reference is Barrett-Westbury, in fact. Tarantino had some really good inputs, and Barrett-Westbury were the first people to write the full mathematical treatment. So they're the ones who should get the credit for it. But they didn't write a nice sort of like local Hamiltonian sort of description. They were writing a kind of much more like a Lagrangian description in space.
Thanks again for having me here.